Welcome to the Fairhaven Church Sermons Podcast. Fairhaven is a part of Harbor Churches, a multi-site church located in West Michigan, and we exist to help people find their way back to God. We hope this message helps you to take your next step in your faith journey. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Good morning, Fairhaven. My name is Jeremy, one of the pastors here. And this morning, we have some ground to cover this morning. And so I want to invite you right off the bat, if you want to follow along, we will put all the words on the screens, but if you want to follow along, we're going to be in Exodus chapter 4 this morning. And for those of you that are newer, a little bit about kind of what we've been doing and where we're at. We started a handful of weeks ago working through the book of Exodus. We here at Fairhaven across Harbor Churches, we'll take a book from the scriptures and we will dive into it, taking it story after story, watching the way the stories develop, asking what is God doing in the stories? What is God looking to teach us through these stories? And so we started a handful of weeks ago looking at the book of Exodus. And so just to kind of catch us up to speed, we started in the book of Exodus seeing the Hebrew people in Egypt. The Israelite people, they're in Egypt, and we saw the Pharaoh becomes really paranoid because the Hebrew people are growing. And so the Pharaoh decides the best thing to do is to oppress them, to enslave them. He sees them continue to grow. So he calls this edict forth, this command, to have all Hebrew baby boys killed by being thrown into the Nile River. We then met a young family with a new baby boy, a baby we will come to know by the name of Moses. This family, they raise this baby boy the first handful of months of his life in their own home. Then they will place him in a basket, send it down the Nile. A Pharaoh's daughter, a member of Pharaoh's own court, will see this baby in a basket, will essentially adopt him into her home, and then literally Moses will grow for the next 40 years of his life in the court, in the family, in the house of the Pharaoh in Egypt. We see this boy become a man. We see Moses go out and he sees one of the Hebrew people being beaten by an Egyptian, so he retaliates, he strikes back, he kills the Egyptian and has to flee. He will spend 40 years in the desert, shepherding a flock in the desert of Midian, when at the end of that 40 years is the story that we've been looking at for the last few weeks. It's maybe one of the most popular, most well-known stories from the book of Exodus. It's when God appears to Moses in the burning bush. God appears and God gives Moses this new mission, this call on his life. Go back to Pharaoh. Go back to Egypt and demand the Hebrew people, demand my people go free. And so Moses and God have this interaction at the bush, and then Moses will take off. So he starts heading back to Pharaoh, and then there's the story we're going to look at this morning. It's the obvious thing that you know is going to happen next between God telling Moses to go back to Pharaoh through the burning bush and Moses going back to Pharaoh. On the way, this is the story we're going to look at this morning, when God tries to kill Moses. Weird. And I promise you, it's in the story. It's there. It's probably the thing, if you've ever read the book of Exodus, it's probably the thing you just quickly read over and dismiss. But God tries to kill Moses. And so we're going to dive into that story this morning. And I promise you, I wish the story was just as clean as this, because you'll find as we dive into the story, the story's even weirder than simply God wanting to kill Moses. It is an odd story. And so, like, if you're here for the first time because you're here for baptism or whatever, and you're looking at each other going, what is happening? Rest assured, everybody else is also looking at each other wondering what is happening. But I want to show you the story, and then we're going to dive into the story. Exodus chapter 4, starting at verse 18. It says, then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, let me return to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive. Jethro said, go, and I wish you well. Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all those who wanted to kill you are dead. So Moses took his wife and sons, put them on a donkey and started back to Egypt, and he took the staff of God in his hand. The Lord said to Moses, when you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says. Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so that he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son. Then it gets weird. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah, this is Moses' wife, Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, I told you it gets weird, and touched Moses' feet with it, even weirder. Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me, she said. So the Lord let him alone. At that time, she said, bridegroom of blood, referring to circumcision. It's a weird story. And it's one of those stories, if you're looking at each other going, why are we doing this one? You learn something important about who we are as a church. Part of why we do long form series, working through books of the scriptures, is it would be a lot easier for people like me who stand on stages like this to skip stories like that. Right? It would be a whole lot easier to grab stories that are easier to preach, that are easier to dive into. But we take the words of the scriptures seriously enough that we want to dive in and do the hard work of exploring what's going on and even some of the most weird stories in the scriptures, right? And so what we want to do this morning is I want to do that work this morning and also name that this is just, it is a odd passage that if you study, you're going to find that scholars over across time, across place, have dug into this passage, and there's a number of different kind of theories and ideas. And so I want to show you, as I've done my work on it, how I'm reading this passage, how it makes sense to me and fits within the larger narrative. But in order to do that, we first need to step back and look at the context. One of the things we believe here is that the scriptures, the context of the scriptures matters. That these words and these verses aren't just dropped out of the middle of nowhere, but they're part of a larger story. And so, like many stories, in order to understand the story, we need to step back and kind of take a look at the larger story that it finds itself in. And so what I want to do is do that, to step back, look at a story we've looked at for the last few weeks of God meeting Moses at the burning bush. And instead of doing what we've done the last few weeks by diving into that story and looking really deeply at a piece of it, to kind of look at it as a whole. And before we get there, I want to try to help you get into the story, to picture the story. And so we know the story starts with Moses as a shepherd doing the things he would have done every day. He's shepherding his flock. He's just going about his day. And so if we try to put ourselves in the story, envision it's almost like you get in your car, right? It's you, your family, you get in the car and you're headed off somewhere. You jump onto the highway. Maybe you're headed to work. Maybe you're headed, my kids play sports, and so most of my life is now driving to whatever gym my kids are going to play whatever at. And so envision you're in your car, you're driving down the highway, and you have that thing that, you know, you always dread on a long road trip, is you see up ahead all of these brake lights start to light up. Right? And so you have this, oh shoot, how long is this going to take? What's going on? You find yourself in this traffic jam. So you're stuck with a bunch of other cars. You see up ahead, the cars in the right lane start moving over to the left. And so you do the same. And now you're kind of single file in the left lane. And it's that moment you see what the commotion is, why the backup, that on the offside of the right side of the lane, you see something like this. You see a car on fire on the side of the road. Anybody ever drive past a car on fire on the side of the road? It's crazy. But so you merge over to the left. You're driving past it, and it's one of those things that once you see it, like, you can't take your eyes away, right? You're watching this car burning on the side of the road. And now let's envision, so you're in the left lane, you're going slowly because that's how it works. you realize something in that moment. Because what you realize as you're watching the car burn on the side of the highway, you realize that unlike the car in this picture, you realize the car's burning, but it's not burning up, right? You realize it's on fire, but it's not being consumed. It's burning, but it's not burning up. And so you hit the driver, whoever's driving, like, hey, we have to pull over and see this strange sight, why the car is burning, but not burning up, right? And they tell you, like, we've got places to go. We've got things to do. What are you talking about? You force them, no, we need to pull over. And so you pull over, you get out of your car, and you approach this strange thing, the car that's burning but isn't being consumed. It's not burning up. And at that moment, as you approach, an angel of the Lord appears. I envision this is exactly what it would have looked like. But imagine you're on the side of the road, you're approaching the car that is burning but not being consumed, and all of a sudden an angel of the Lord appears out of the car that's burning but not being consumed and says, the first thing they say is your name. Weird, right? Like, so this, okay, what is happening? This angel in this thing knows my name, and then the angel proceeds to tell you, I know what you're doing, where you're going, what you're up to, where you're headed to, but I have a message to you from God that God is calling you to do something different. And then the angel lays out for you what God is calling you to do. What do you do in that moment? What do you do? I mean, can we name, it would be hard to disagree with an angel of the Lord speaking from a fire that is not being consumed, that knows you by name and calls you to do something with your life. It'd be hard to disagree with that, right? My guess is you probably start calling important people in your life like, hey, so like this thing just happened and I'm not exactly sure what it's gonna look like, but like, how do you say no to this? Like, I'm going to have to do whatever it tells me, right? Like, that's my guess is how you're gonna respond. What's interesting to me is this isn't how Moses responds. Moses doesn't see the car burning but not being consumed. Moses sees a bush that's burning and not being consumed. This angel of the Lord appears, calls him by name, gives him a mission, a message from God, something he's supposed to give his life to. And Moses does not go, okay, let's go. Moses will start giving a bunch of objections, a bunch of reasons why God is wrong. And so what I want to do is I actually want to spend a little bit of time looking at those objections, because Moses is going to give an objection and then God is going to respond to Moses' objection. So let's start with the call that God gives Moses. So God says, now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. There's the command, the call, the mission. Moses is going to give his first objection. His first, God, you're wrong. Moses is going to say this first. So Moses says to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? His first thing, who am I? Like, Pharaoh is the leader of the largest nation in the world has ever seen. Who am I? And out here, I want to play a game with the story this morning. Is that all right? So what I want to do is, like I said, Moses is going to give an objection. God is going to respond to the objection. I want to invite us this morning to kind of play the role of like jury, of judges, that we get to determine who wins a point between Moses' objection and God's response to the objection. Which one wins? And so if I start with the scoreboard, so we've got God versus Moses. We've got a score of 0-0. God says, go to the Pharaoh, demand the Hebrew people go free. Moses responds, who am I that I should go? Now let's take a look at God's response to Moses. God says, I will be with you. The Moses' objection, who am I? God's response is essentially, that doesn't matter because I am going to go with you. Moses, who are you? That's exactly the point. It doesn't depend on you. It's not about you. It's about me partnering with you to free my people. Moses, who are you? I am the one who will go with you. And so if you're gonna score it, if we go back to our scoreboard, we're 0-0, who gets your point? I'm giving the point to God, right? Anybody disagree with giving the point to God? I'm giving it to God. So we're 1-0. God is shocking. God's ahead, right? So we go to Moses' second objection. Moses' second one, he says this. Moses says to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what's his name? What should I tell them? God, I don't know enough. God, you're going to send me to the Pharaoh. They've got gods for everything. Their gods have names. You're telling me to go to say you want your people to go free. But like, what is your name? God responds. It's the passage we looked at last week. God said to Moses, I am who I am. He gives his kind of divine name. This is what you are saying to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And then God kind of doubles down. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. So Moses' objection, God, I don't even know your name. God says, okay, I'll give you my name. He gives a name, and then God doubles down and says, oh, by the way, I am also the God who has been the God of your people from the very beginning. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of your people, that is who I am. And so if we go back to our scoreboard, where God won, Moses 0, who do you give the point to? God wins again. I love it. So at this point, we've got a score of 2-0 when Moses keeps going. Moses has his third objection he's going to bring to God. The third objection is this. Moses answered, what if they don't believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you? No, I get this one. This one makes sense, right? Like Moses is thinking, I'm going to stand before Pharaoh and like Pharaoh's going to think I'm a crazy person, right? I'm going to show up and be like, so here's the thing. Like this bush told me that I need to come to you and make this demand that you let your workforce go. Like what if they don't believe me? And now here, I wish we had another like half hour to dive into God's response, but I mean, the lions don't start till 1, so okay, I wish we had more time. But God to this response is essentially, we won't read it. I'll just explain it to you. Moses saying, what if they don't believe me? God will give Moses 3 signs. God says, okay, well, first, what you do is take your staff and throw your staff on the ground. And when you throw your staff on the ground, it will turn into a snake. When you then grab the snake, it will turn back into a staff. That's the first sign. And then God says, okay, if they don't believe that one, let's give them a second sign. The second sign, he says, if you take your hand and you put it in your cloak, when you take it out, you'll see that it turned leprous. It's covered with skin disease. If you put it back in your cloak and pull it out, now it's clean. And then God says, okay, if they don't listen to the second sign, they'll surely listen to the third sign. And the third sign, God says, is take water out of the Nile, pour the water on the ground, and in that moment, the water will have turned to blood. God says, if they don't believe the first two, they'll believe the third. So if we go back to our scoreboard, Moses saying, what if they don't believe me? And God gives 3 things, a staff turning into a snake, turning back into a staff, a hand turning leprous and then clean, and Nile river water turning into blood. Do I even have to ask? Can we just give that point to God? Can we do that? Okay. God is up 3-0. And at this point, as I'm reading the story, I find that I start asking a couple questions. My first question I find myself asking is this. Why is Moses still objecting? Why is Moses still objecting? I mean, remember, as if the whole angel of God coming from the bush that is on fire but not being consumed, our car that's not being, as if that isn't enough. Moses gives his first objection, God wins the point. Moses gives his next objection, God wins the point. Moses gives his third objection, God wins the point. Why? At some point, I anticipate Moses is going to go, okay, you win, I get it, I'll go. Why does Moses keep objecting? It almost feels to me as I'm reading through the story that Moses, the actual objection is less the things that he's saying, but there's gotta be something more behind it. right? There's got to be something else going on deeper in Moses that is causing him to keep objecting. And then it causes me to ask a second question, this one. Why doesn't God move on? There's plenty of shepherds in Midian, right? There's plenty of, why is it that after Moses keeps objecting, he keeps pushing back, why is it that God seems intent on saying, no, Moses, you are my guy. You're the guy. Why doesn't God just go, okay, you know what? Forget it. I'll find somebody else to go. Why does God seem intent that Moses is the guy? And what I think we find as we dive further into the story is that the answer to both of those questions, the why does Moses keep objecting and why doesn't God move on? Why does God keep insisting Moses is the guy? I think we find as we keep diving into the passage that the answer to both of those questions, I think, is the same thing. That it's the same answer that answers both questions. But in order to get there, we need to jump back into our objections. Objection number four, because three isn't enough for Moses. Moses is going to push again. Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. Moses all of a sudden has manners, right? I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. Moses essentially like, God, you want me to go to the Pharaoh? I'm not the guy that's going to be able to convince him. You don't want me. I'm slow to speak. God's response, God kind of pulls out a doozy on this one. The Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. There's a great Hebrew word that describes what just happened. It's called a burn, right? Like, God, I don't talk good. Who gave you your mouth, right? Like, we'll put the scoreboard up, but again, I don't think I even need to ask. Like, God wins the point, right? So God is now up 4-0. And in my head, at this point in the story, Moses is starting to really kind of feel what it would feel like to be anybody this year going up against the Detroit Lions, right? You don't stand a chance. Like, this game is over before it starts. You are done. Or even to make it a little closer to home, our 2024 Hudsonville Eagles winning district yesterday. Let's go. Such a fun game. But Moses at this point is upside down 4-0. And at this point, I think Moses starts to realize that he doesn't stand a chance. He's losing. He's going to lose. And so Moses almost feels like he changes his strategy here. That instead of giving God a reason why he's not the right guy, Moses' fifth objection, he says this. But Moses said, pardon your servant. Lord, please find somebody else. Please send someone else. God, it's not me. I'm not the right guy. Just move on, find somebody else. So after four times he's trying to convince God to send somebody else, the fifth time Moses essentially looks at God and says, no, I'm out, I'm not the right guy, find someone else, send them. God then seems to shift his strategy in response to Moses. Let's take a look at that. It says, then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, now pay attention to this. What about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he can speak well. Now, this is interesting because remember, Moses' fourth objection is, I don't speak very well. And God already won that point, right? He said, like, I gave you your mouth, we'll figure it out. But God goes back to it. He says, Aaron, your brother, is already on his way to meet you, and he'll be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if it were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so that you can perform the signs with it. Then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, let me return to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive. Notice, so Moses said, find somebody else. God says, what about your brother? And immediately Moses goes, okay, I'm in. Let's go. My question is why? Why does this exchange with God tip him? Moses five times says, no, I'm not the right guy. No, I'm not the right guy. No, I'm not the right guy. And now all of a sudden Moses goes, oh, okay, I'll go. Why now does Moses go? And you could say it's because now Aaron's gonna come with him. So it's like a buddy system thing. Like now he doesn't have to go alone. So like two people standing before Pharaoh will be way better than just one person standing before Pharaoh. But I don't know that I think that's actually what's going on. I think there's more. I think there's something deeper. And I think you find it in that statement when God says Aaron's going to come. Let me put it back up, see if you can catch it. So God says, what about your brother Aaron the Levite? Do you notice anything strange, anything odd, anything maybe unnecessary in the statement? How about this piece right here? We'll highlight it. The Levite. Essentially what that means is that Aaron comes from the tribe or the family of Levi. So my question, why does God include that? Because if Aaron is Moses' brother, wouldn't Moses already know that? Right? It feels like it would be similar. My last name's Cruz. It feels like it would be similar to if somebody were to tell me, like, your sister, a descendant of the Cruz family, is coming to meet you. I'd be like, that was really weird, right? Like, you don't need to say that. Or like, your sister who comes from a Dutch heritage is coming to, of course she is. Like, why are you telling, it's unnecessary unless God is doing something. See, I wonder in the passage if this isn't so that Moses knows which brother or God's just adding unnecessary words, but I wonder in that statement if God isn't reminding Moses of something important, that God isn't reminding Moses of his identity, of who he is. Because if we back up in the story of Moses, so much of the early story of Moses is a question about identity. About who is Moses? Who is his family? Where does he belong? Because remember, Moses is born into a Hebrew family. He's born Hebrew. He's raised for the first few months of his life as a Hebrew baby boy. He is then put into that basket and he's sent down the Nile to be adopted into Pharaoh's daughter's household. So he's born Hebrew, but he's raised Egyptian. And then there's the interesting thing when Pharaoh's daughter sees him, the first thing she says is she recognizes that he's one of the Hebrew babies. Question, how does she know? Right? It's a baby in a basket, unless we know what happens to Hebrew babies at 8 days old. Moses was almost surely circumcised. And so he carries the seal of the covenant promise that God made to his people. And he then, at months old, is adopted into Pharaoh's daughter's household, into an Egyptian household. She sees he bears the mark of the covenant of the Hebrews, raises him as an Egyptian. Moses, and how does he know when he goes out and sees the Egyptian striking the Hebrew, that the Hebrew's his people? Probably because he carries that sign, right? He's been circumcised, so he knows. And then you wonder how many other people know. Moses knows, but it's not like everybody knows. And then he's so raised Egyptian that when he strikes that Egyptian, when he kills him and has to flee, he'll find those women at the well, the one who becomes his wife, Zipporah. They will go back and report to dad what just happened, and they'll explain it this way. They said, an Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock. Moses looks Egyptian. He probably sounds Egyptian. He, by all accounts, is Egyptian. And yet Moses knows he's not Egyptian. He's Hebrew. And so to the question, why is Moses still objecting? I think in a lot of ways to Moses, the whole situation just feels so incredibly complicated. Who is Moses? Who does he belong to? Because in a lot of ways, he belongs to both, and he also doesn't really belong to either, right? Like, born Hebrew, raised Egyptian, and for the last 40 years, he's been a shepherd with the Midianites, which is a whole different group of people. So to Moses, the call to go back, and again, if he grew up in Pharaoh's daughter's household, He grew up in the royal family. So who is the Pharaoh now? None other than, did Moses call the new Pharaoh brother growing up? Right? It would have been family. And so in a lot of ways, God is meeting Moses, saying, go back to the Pharaoh, somebody that you at some point in your life would have called family, to the Egyptians, who at one point were kind of your people, and declare to Pharaoh that he let the Hebrew people, your people, go. And to Moses, the whole thing just feels so incredibly complicated. And then we have that story where Moses sets off. He's reminded, I think, of who he is, that his brother is a Levite, so he is a Levite. He has a family. He has a people. He is one of the Hebrew people. And so in that moment, Moses is convinced and says, okay, I'll go. And then we stumble into that weird story, the story we started with. I want to put it back up because there's a detail in this story I want to see if we can catch. It says, at a lodging place along the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, touched Moses' feet with it. Surely you're a bridegroom of blood to me, she said. So the Lord let him alone. At that time, she said, bridegroom of blood, referring to circumcision. In the story, what do we learn that Moses never did for his kid? He's never given him the actual sign of the covenant. Moses has never circumcised his kid, which, remember, is a big deal. Because in the book of Genesis, we went through it about a year ago, God says, this is the sign of the covenant that I am your God, that you are my people. This is the thing. Do this to every one of your sons at 8 days old so that they may bear the sign of the covenant. And now God is trying to tell Moses, God, Moses, you are to go to the Pharaoh to demand my people, the Hebrew people, my firstborn, go. And along the way, we find out Moses has never actually committed his kid to this God. So it's almost as if in the story, God is telling Moses and his family, like, I need you all in. If you are going to be the people, if you're going to be the person to stand before Pharaoh and demand that my firstborn son, the Hebrew people, go, I need to know that you will at least commit your firstborn to me. And as of yet, you have held him back. And so it's in this moment that it's almost like Zipporah on behalf of the family picks sides. Like, we are in, it's almost at this point they say, yes, we're in. The Hebrew people are our people. We are going to do the job. Which then brings me to that second question. Why doesn't God move on? Why was God so intent that Moses was the right guy? I think the answer, again, is the same answer to why does Moses keep objecting? Because the whole thing is complicated. Because when God looks down on the people, God calls Israel his firstborn son, but to have a firstborn son means you also have other children, right? I think we find something important. Does it answer everything of the goofy of the story? No. But I think the story shows us something important about the heart of God, that God looks at Israel as his firstborn, but he looks at every human on earth, every people, as his children. And God finds himself in this incredibly difficult spot where his firstborn son is crying out because they are being oppressed. But who they're being oppressed by are other people that God would call his children, right? And that God looks down on his kids who are abusing one another, and God says, I'll do anything for my children. I'll do anything for my kids. But Moses, I think God recognizes that Moses is the only person who can do the job, because Moses, God could have found somebody else to stand before the Pharaoh. But Moses is the only guy who could stand before the Pharaoh with a tear in his eye, because these were also his family. right? This was his family, and God's looking down going, Moses, you are the right guy because you care about the Egyptians as well, and so I'm gonna send you to them. And it's almost as if God is saying, Moses, go to them and speak their language, bring the plagues to them, show them that I am stronger than, I am bigger than all of the false gods, all of the things that they worship. Show them with their language that I am bigger, that I am stronger, that show them because maybe, just maybe they'll turn. And Moses, I know that their hearts are hard. I know they're not going to, but Moses, I care for them as well. And so you are the only person that can reflect my heart to them. Moses, you are the right guy. And then I think it makes sense that as the world continues to tear itself apart, that as God continues to see the division and the destruction, that the story will end up going to a spot where God will send his firstborn, right? God will send his firstborn son in Jesus into the world to do that same work. That Jesus will say he came into the world not to condemn it or to do, but he came to seek and to save and to reconcile everything that is broken back to one another and back to the God who created all of it. That Jesus comes into the world, again, not to look down on and condemn, but to show what the heart of God looks like, that God's heart breaks for all of the ways that the world isn't the way that it should be. And Jesus will go on to call his disciples, who will go on to build churches. And so the thing in the story is, if you're here and you call yourself a follower of Jesus, this is the work before us, right? To model what God sent Moses to do, to model Jesus put on display, and Jesus told his disciples, the things that I do, you will do after me. That was the role of discipleship, to be the people who are to go into the world living in such a way, speaking in such a way, showing the world who God looks like in such a way that all people might come to see him, to know him, to follow, because they're able to see through the church, through you, through I, through the way the church goes out into the world, to see through it to the person of Jesus, the one whom we follow. And so in just a few moments, I'm gonna invite you to stand and essentially commission us, bless us, speak over us, because that is the role. Those of us who call ourselves followers of Jesus, it is our role the New Testament says, right, we are in the world, but not of it, to go out into a world that is constantly broken and divided and fighting one another, and to show the world a different way. John, Jesus' closest disciple, John would say that they will know we are Christians by our love, by the way we live and act and treat one another. And so, friends, would you please stand? Friends, as you go, would you put the heart of God on display? Would you give your life to following hard after the way of Jesus, to go out into the world, letting your light shine, living your life in such a way that when the world sees you, they see through you to the one who sent you, that they say they see Jesus? And as you go, may the Lord bless you and keep you. May he make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May he turn his face towards you, and may he give you peace. Amen.
Thanks for listening. Our hope is that you are encouraged and that God revealed a piece of his character to you through this message. For service times or for more information about how you can be a part of Fairhaven, you can visit us at fhchurch.org. Have a great week.